Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I want to start with what happened last night involving the LA Lakers. I want to start with something that was said on the program yesterday. Do you remember when Mark Stein came on the show? And he said that the Lakers yesterday, he said that they were just on another level from everybody else in the association. He said that before the game. Fast forward to the end of yesterday's show, to the start of the Lakers-Cavaliers game in Cleveland, and then you get a taste of exactly what that so-called next level looks like. Because that next level looks like LeBron, Raymond James. And that next level is badass. What he did last night in Cleveland was pretty unreal, even for him. Remember, that was his first appearance in C-Town in more than 2 years due to the pandemic. Clearly, though, he had that one circled in red ink. And he made Cleveland pay. Not the entire city, not even like the entire team, but just one guy. And I'll get to that in a moment. But in the first quarter, LeBron was cooking. He opened up his account with a three just over 2 minutes into the game. Then he really went to work. He scored 14 points in the first 11-plus minutes. It's a nice quarter. It's a great quarter. It's a great homecoming. And then he capped off the quarter with this.
He'll probably get the last shot with two on its way. That a way to end the quarter with the King drilling another three.
So, if you did not know before that shot, you knew it after it went down. LeBron, in the words of the legendary David Goggins, was coming to snatch souls. Anthony Davis knew.
I knew when he had 19 in the first, 17 in the first, or something like that. Oh, it's over.
I knew when he had 17 in the first. I thought, it's over. Yeah, it was over. It was over for Cleveland, but it was only starting for LeBron because he had the full arsenal on display. There was the rain of threes in the first quarter. Then in the second quarter, the full display of power and explosiveness.
He had a layup a minute ago, but other than that, hasn't shot much since coming back in.
Down the middle he goes, and nobody's going to stop him with the two-hand jam.
Listen, last night, I really don't care what Cleveland did for the next three quarters. They were not going to win last night. Man, they could have rolled out Mark Price, Austin Carr, Larry Nance, Brad Doherty, and Craig Elo, all in their primes. All in their primes. Gerald Wilkins, Mike Fratello. They still were not beating LeBron last night because last night was personal. And not just because LeBron was back in C-Town, but because somebody from the Cavaliers organization managed to get under his skin. Something you just do not want to do, ever. You see, when LeBron had a look at a game-tying 14-footer as the third quarter ended, it bounced twice on the rim, and it fell out. And at that point, somebody from the Cavs organization apparently was clapping and celebrating a little bit too hard.
Felt like he was just a little bit too excited about seeing me miss, you know. But he was really excited about me missing, that shot. A little bit more extra than I would have liked. But, you know, he got a root for his team, obviously. And he was he showcased that, so, you know. I knew I had another quarter, and the fourth quarter is my favorite.
So LeBron would not say who the over-enthusiastic member of the Cavaliers organization was, I should say, but he made it pretty clear. If you want to find out who it is, it's not hard to find out.
It's a million cameras in these arenas. Y'all just got to find a clip. Just see how excited he was when I missed. I didn't take it well.
This is so funny to me. Like, that a guy like LeBron James, for everything he's accomplished, would take that as such an insult that somebody clapped too hard over a miss. These guys are the absolute best. I mean, that is hilarious, and it's real. In the meantime, ESPN did identify the clapper. ESPN identified that overly enthusiastic clapper as Jason Hillman, the team's basketball chief of staff. And apparently the Cavaliers have him to blame, but the rest of us have him to thank, because what happened next was one of the all-time great quarters from LeBron. And that's saying something now. He said it himself. We know how he feels about the fourth quarter. He outscored Cleveland 21-19 in the fourth quarter. He was 9 of 10 from the field with 2 steals, 2 assists, and 2 blocks. And the 2 blocks don't even include this.
from Harrell. So he tried to force it up. Sexton. Well, LeBron blocks it. That's going to count. Goaltending. That's going to count. Style factor was off the chart.
Yeah, it looked like it was over the cylinder, though. He was arcing it, but it was still over the cylinder. Sexton takes it the distance and throws it up, and LeBron just swats it away.
That chase down LeBron defense that he's become known for.
I don't even care that ball was over the cylinder. Did you see how high that guy got up? That's a 36-year-old man who's played like a billion minutes going that high for that block. That shouldn't happen. That should be physically impossible. So forget calling goaltending. They got to change the rules for that play alone. Call it a block. Give the Lakers the bucket. Hell, give them the ball. It's only the right thing to do. It's the only right thing to do in that moment. But the guy still wasn't done. He was not done humiliating that dude who was clapping too hard. He still had this shot from the logo. You want something to clap about? I will give you something to clap about.
Wants a three. Doesn't get the defender in the air. We've only got three to shoot.
Logo.
Logo three for LeBron.
Logo.
Ring up another logo three.
Another look at that logo three by LeBron. I mean, that was legit.
That was legit. A logo three. So I hope that dude was clapping about that too. And if he was not clapping for that shot, he sure as hell better been clapping for this. If you watch that game, you know what I'm talking about. Because this is probably the most ridiculous shot on a ridiculous night. It's the shot you're going to remember from the game. Go ahead, Alvy, roll it.
Up a little bit more time. Start looking to go now.
Trying to get it in the fridge. LeBron, tough shot.
Nothing
too tough for the King tonight.
Got the clock winding down. Double team coming. Turnaround, fadeaway.
This dude. Turnaround, fadeaway over the double team to ice that game. Like, that's the kind of shot that you take in your driveway, and then you take it, and then you brick it, and then you try and try and try again and keep trying to make that shot, and you never make it. Not even you, Rit. Not even you, Rit. Except, Ambi.
Ambi.
Except LeBron does it in a game and buries it with ease. All of this from the alleged washed king. All of this from a 36-year-old with crazy miles on him. All of this from a guy who should not be playing at this level. All of this from a guy who should be coasting. Except not only is he not coasting, I mean, this is like heresy. This guy might be getting better. This guy is actually improving. I mean, it seems unreal. It seems unfair. But the fact of the matter is, he went 7 for 11 from deep last night. He's now shooting 41.2% from the three-point land. From the three-point line. I mean, that's the best percentage of the guy's entire career. So not only is he not slowing down, he's actually getting better. He added another weapon to an already unstoppable arsenal. Remember all those idiots back in the day who said that LeBron just doesn't want it badly enough. LeBron doesn't have that killer instinct. LeBron doesn't finish like an MJ or a Bird or the other greats. Remember all those folks who said the guy was just too nice. He was just too interested in other things to be the GOAT. That he was nothing more than a facilitator, but not a cold-blooded killer. Right? Remember that. So how does that argument look right about now? Has there ever been a take that aged worse than that? Four rings and still doing stuff like this in a regular season, in January, in an empty arena. If anybody ever earned the right to cruise through a regular season game in January in an empty arena, it's LeBron James, especially after what he did last season and especially after such a short offseason. Instead, this guy's out here wrecking teams and putting a clown suit on a basketball chief of staff. And it's awesome. Memo to any NBA execs, staff members, scouts, PR, HR, coach, anybody. If you're going to attend a Laker game, leave all your emotions at the door. No fist pumps, no high fives, no clapping, no eye rolls, no chest bumps, no nothing. Don't even think about starting up the wave. For the sake of your squad. Man, don't give this guy any more fuel than necessary.
Felt like he was just a little bit too excited about seeing me miss. You know?
This guy goes historic. This guy goes off because he saw somebody on the other side clapping too enthusiastically. Man, that's hilarious. Very, very funny to me. And I'm glad it happened. You're one of a kind, and so are your taxes. That's why TurboTax Live has experienced tax experts who are ready to listen to you, learn about your unique tax situation, and help you get the best tax outcome. Maybe you're moonlighting as a rideshare driver and have questions about what qualifies as a deduction. Maybe you want an expert to walk you through the process, since most of your income last year came from freelance jobs. Or maybe you would like to hand the whole tax filing process off to an expert while you perfect your banana bread recipe. Whether you want to file with the help of an expert or let the expert do the filing for you, TurboTax Live Tax Experts are there to help. They're there to give you the confidence that you need to know. Whether you want to file with the help of an expert or let an expert do the filing for you, TurboTax Live Tax Experts are here to help, giving you the confidence to know that your one-of-a-kind, uniquely you taxes are done right. Intuit TurboTax Live. We are joined by their head coach, Arthur Smith. Arthur, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks so much. How are you?
Great, Jim. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. So dial me in. What's it been like for the last week and a half since you were named head coach of the Atlanta Falcons? What's the time been like for you? How is life for you right about now?
Well, it's been good. I got to say that there are good problems to have, and it's been a whirlwind. I've been really busy trying to make sure we get the staff right and any other tasks that's come my way. And so really just trying to get through that, make sure we get the staff, and then we got to dive into this personnel.
All right, so when you look at successful organizations around the league, it seems to me one of the things that really jumps out is the relationship between a head coach and the GM. So how would you describe the relationship that you and Terry Fontenot have, and how excited are you to get started with him?
I'm really excited about working with Terry. Terry and I, you know, this will be a shared vision. Everything we'll do will be collaborative. We'll certainly, you know, we'll have our own opinions, but we'll come to an agreement. But it's definitely going to be a shared vision. And Terry's the perfect guy for that job.
You know, when you talk about shared vision and your own opinions, I know that that definitely factors into your leadership style. I'm going to ask you about that in a moment. But when I look back on your career, you started your coaching career as a graduate assistant in North Carolina. Then you worked on the defensive side of the ball in the NFL with Washington and in college at Ole Miss, and then back in the NFL with the Titans. So how did you go about making that switch from defense to offense, and what was that transition like?
Well, I'd been an offensive lineman in college, and then I GA'd. I worked with the O-line, and then I was really a scouting assistant in Washington. And then Joe Gibbs, you know, had a spot on the staff. And he said, do you want to do quality control? And I said, absolutely. And it was on defense. And we had a great staff. And a lot of it was film breakdown and learning the defense. And whatever job, you try to do a good job with what you had. And you got more. And then I got enamored with working on defense, which is pretty common. You got guys that are quarterbacks in college that move over to defense. They become defensive coordinators or head coaches. So I thought I was going to carve my path out to be a defensive coach. I got hired in Tennessee to do that. And then Mike Munchak was the one that switched me over in 12. He knew I'd been a lineman and, you know, asked if I, you know, wanted to be a line coach or an offensive coach. And I said, yeah, I love the offensive line. And if I do that, I mean, I eventually want to be a coordinator and try to be a head coach. And so Munch was the one that moved me over.
Falcons head coach Arthur Smith is my guest. You know, you mentioned about life as a GA. I'm curious about that, too, because you go back to your time in North Carolina. The story goes that after you were done playing at North Carolina, you had an opportunity to go into investment banking in Hong Kong, but instead you accepted John Bunting's offer to be a GA in North Carolina. That's a grind, right? That's not an easy life. What do you remember about that time in your life and your career?
Well, certainly I was trying to figure out the next chapter, and there was a couple things I bounced around. I knew I wanted to get into coaching. I thought maybe there was something different, kind of see the world. And then the opportunity presented itself, and Coach Bunning called me and told me he had a job. He and I had talked about getting into coaching. So I jumped at it, just figured that, you know, it might not come around again, especially at a school like that, at a Power 5 school. Even though I'd been there and played there, still I jumped at the opportunity.
We're talking Atlanta Falcons head coach Arthur Smith. You made the point too, quote, I've taken leadership lessons from a lot of different businesses. I love reading about history. I'm curious, are there particular books or stories that resonate with you on how to be a leader, and how do you approach that role?
Well, it's not necessarily like the how-to books. It's more, I love people's stories. I mean, you learn a lot from any industry. I mean, it could be from music to television, entertainment, military. I mean, that's kind of a direct parallel sometimes because there are some stressful lessons. But I'd never pretend that, you know, we're in the seriousness of what those guys do because they're actually dealing with real life and death. But there are some very good leadership lessons. One of the better books I read was On Desperate Ground by Hampton Sides, which is about the Korean War. Didn't know a lot about that, and somebody recommended that, and some unbelievable stories of decision-making, you know, in the Frozen Chosen, and the things that you try to, you know, learn from as guys that were good leaders that have been through some tough times. But I try to learn from everyone.
I was going to say, Arthur, sorry to interrupt. I was going to say also, in terms of leadership, like the late Pepper Rodgers, I know he was an early mentor for you. What kind of an impact did he have on you as a person and as a coach?
Well, his impact was more, you know, it got me curious about the game of football. You know, Pepper was a lively character. I don't know if you've ever interacted with him. He's one of those guys that lived 100 lives. You know, he lived a full life. You know, when his time out in L.A., he just knew everybody. You know, he had coached Steve Spurrier, and he, you know, he took me to a Florida State game when I was young. And I got to meet Steve Spurrier, and I was just, I loved the stories and the game. I started playing early, and it kind of brought a lot of the history of the game to life for me. And so he had a huge impact early on in my interest.
We're talking to Falcons head coach Arthur Smith. Listen, I know it's early to talk about the draft and personnel, but when you look at the talent that you have on that roster, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Well, like I said, it is early in this process. I mean, Terry and I were just now starting with filling out the staffs, and we got a long way to go as we evaluate this roster. Because as you know, there's always decisions to be made. It never stays the same. There are good pieces here. Clearly there's been just talented players on this roster and guys we look forward to working with. But we're still so early in how we want to attack this offseason free agency and through the draft.
Yeah, I got to ask you something. For instance, like I know you're looking ahead and not back, but from the outside, it seems to me almost everybody on that Titans offense played the best football of their careers. When you were the offensive coordinator, I know you're probably not going to want to take credit for that, but how did you go about developing an offense that could maximize the abilities of so many guys?
Well, it's a credit to those guys. I mean, we had good players, and you know, we had a certain identity from the top down, from Mike Vrabel and John Robinson, and the way they built that culture. And we had an identity. We felt we were a very tough physical football team, and we had tough physical players and tried to use those guys' skill sets. I mean, everybody from Derek to Ryan to Roger Saffold to A.J. Brown, Corey Davis, John Smith, the list goes on and on and on. And just really just practical as that, we try to play to the strengths of our players.
Arthur Smith joining me for a few more moments. I'm curious about Ryan Tannehill. For instance, he was a backup when he arrived in Tennessee, and there was this sense that maybe he had not lived up to his talent or his potential during his time in Miami. What did you see in him, and how did you go about working with him?
Yeah, it was a unique position for Ryan to be in. You know, he never got to hit free agency, and we wouldn't have, and I give John a lot of credit for pulling that trade off. And so Ryan got there, and it was different. You know, he had been drafted in Miami to be the guy, and so it was a new role for him, and that thing could have been a disaster if you'd had the wrong personalities in there. And what I mean by that, I can't give Marcus Mariota and Ryan Tannehill enough credit who they are as people. That's a tough room when you've got guys that both can play and both of them had high expectations. And so, you know, not to speak for Ryan, but that was probably very humbling for him, and he took he took advantage of it. He didn't pout. He tried to be the best backup he could be. Marcus, and I knew he had a burning desire to play, and he told me that, but I give Ryan a lot of credit because that wasn't easy to do. And then we flip it around when the decision was made, when Ryan became the starter. Marcus did a great job in that role, and that was hard for him. And those two guys, their personalities, I just can't thank them enough because that could have been a disaster.
So what we're talking about here are a couple of professionals. So when you look at film right now of Matt Ryan, what jumps out at you?
Certainly. I mean, Matt's decision-making. I mean, Matt's had a great career. He's very decisive with the football, and he's very intelligent and very active. And so, you know, when you get to work with a veteran, a guy that's had thousands of reps, that certainly helps. His strengths, you know, his skill sets. I mean, I've never been wanting to compare guys, you know, because he's got his strengths. Ryan had his. But I won't do that. I mean, we'll build around our guys, the strength of this team.
So let me finally ask you this then. When you talk about building this team and the strength around the team, you know, again, from the outside looking in, that Titans offense, for instance, to me, had a really clear identity. So what is an Arthur Smith Atlanta Falcons team going to look like? What do you want people to think of when they think of the Falcons now?
Yeah, you still want that mentality. We're going to play with great effort. We're going to pride ourselves on being physical and tough. And I know a lot of people say that, but we're going to implement that and find the right players to do that. Now, having said that, you know, our skill players, they will be different than the ones we had in Tennessee. So it's my job to figure out what they do best. And, you know, the pieces that are currently here play to their strengths. If we have different strengths on the perimeter, then obviously we'll end up passing a little bit more. But we feel good. We want to be balanced, but we don't have a set number. But we want to be physical, and we want to be flexible and be adaptable. That's what I want the identity to be of this team.
Today is the one-year anniversary of the helicopter crash in Calabasas, which took the lives of John Altobelli, Carrie Altobelli, Alyssa Altobelli, Kobe Bryant, Gigi Bryant, Sarah Chester, Peyton Chester, Kristen Mauser, Christina, I should say. Also, Era Zobayan. And I still remember getting the news 1 year ago today. I still remember the shock and the numbness that we all felt then. And 1 year later, it doesn't feel any more real. 1 year later, I'm still trying to wrap my head around the entire thing. I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact that Kobe Bryant is gone. I still remember seeing the tweet from TMZ and thinking it's a hoax, thinking they've been hacked. Because time and time again, we've seen quote unquote reports of celebrities dying, and it turns out to be false. You see something like that, and then a few minutes later or an hour later, you find out that in fact it was a hoax or a hack, and then everybody goes right back to life. But as time passed on that Sunday 1 year ago, there was no retraction. There were only more reports and more confirmations. And then it became clear this was not a hoax. This was not a mistake. This was real. And it feels like a cliche, but this was something that was not supposed to happen. Something like this is not supposed to happen to a person like that. Something like this is not supposed to happen to Kobe Bryant. It reminded me then, as it reminds me right now, of when Pat Tillman died. Pat Tillman was not supposed to die. I mean, sure, we're all human beings. We're all going to die. But Pat Tillman was larger than life. Tillman was supposed to enlist, then come back home once it was all over. The idea that he would not come home, to me, was impossible to fathom. Just like it was impossible to fathom that Kobe Bryant was not going to have another amazing series of chapters to his life. Kobe the girl dad. Kobe the coach, Kobe the mentor, Kobe the storyteller. Kobe was supposed to be invincible. And unlike a lot of other athletes who were directionless in retirement, Kobe had direction. Kobe had focus. Kobe had intensity. He wasn't playing for the Lakers anymore, but he had started something new, something important to him, very important to him, something that he had as much passion and fire and drive for. Which makes it all the more tragic. I can still remember talking to him on this show a few years ago after he had turned 38. And we were talking about life and getting older.
I'm just very thankful being able to have this experience of playing this beautiful game of basketball and to be able to sit here now at 38 years old and having this conversation with you and being able to enjoy my kids growing up. It's been a fantastic ride.
Kobe, how's 38 feel?
Feels awesome, dude. I can't complain, man. I feel awesome. I have more hair on my face than I do on my head, but besides that, it's all good.
I mean, it kind of gives me chills. I mean, it does. It was a special conversation then. It feels surreal now. He wasn't finished. In fact, he was just getting started, and it was truly inspiring. That's part of the reason why 1 year later, it's still awful. It's still terrible. It's still unbelievably painful for Kobe's wife, Vanessa, and their daughters. And I can't begin to imagine the pain of the friends and the family of the Altobellis, for Christina Mauser's husband and family, for the friends and family of Sarah and Peyton Chester, the friends and family of Ara Zobayan. This one was and is personal to Los Angeles. Like, if you don't live here and you haven't spent time here, if you aren't a Laker fan, it's hard to explain the connection between Kobe and this city. But it runs deeper than any relationship between an athlete and a city that I think I've ever seen before and probably ever will see again. LA has had plenty of legends and icons, way more than its fair share. Magic, Kareem, Shaq, Gretzky, LeBron, Sandy, Fernando. Except Kobe was different. I've never seen a city embrace an athlete or an athlete embrace a city the way Kobe loved LA and LA loved Kobe back for a glimpse. This was a moment when he and I talked about whether he would ever leave the Lakers.
You badly want another ring. We've been talking about this. Do you want it badly enough that you would ever leave the Lakers to get it?
No, I can't see myself going any place else. I mean, I was born a Laker. I mean, this is home for me. So, I don't see myself going someplace else just to try to win another championship. You know, my attitude's always been it's going to happen here or it's not going to happen. It's just, that's the way I've always viewed things.
You know, even more amazing to me is the fact that Kobe, of course, was not from L.A. It's not like he was a local kid who grew up here. He's from the other side of the country. He spent some of his childhood on the other side of the world. But this was his home. And it's funny that a city in an area of the country which is known for being laid back, was so connected with a guy who was so fierce. I always found that fascinating. I mean, we're talking about ferociousness in games, in practice, in the weight room, everywhere. Fierce as hell. Competitive as hell. He once told Jackie McMullen, quote, "I could never understand why winning wasn't the most important thing to everyone. Why are you here then?" End quote. And as I've talked in the past a little bit about Kobe, I did know Kobe a little bit. I mean, we weren't super close, but sometimes out of the blue, he'd hit me up and we'd meet up at Javier's. And because we lived in pretty close proximity, I would often see him around town. In fact, all of us who live here would often see him around town. And not seeing Kobe over the past year has been really weird and really surreal in a year that's been really weird and really surreal. I think over the past year, people have tried to explain Kobe's connection to LA and his impact on the people who live here. And it always feels like it falls short. Here's the best way I can sum it up. If you know, you know. If you aren't from here and weren't here when he was here, then no explanation is possible. If you were, no explanation is necessary. And that's why this will never feel real. Like right now, I'm thinking about one of the things I thought about 1 year ago. It was a random Sunday morning in January. I'm not sure why that sticks with me so much, but it always has. It always will. It was just a random day. The things that we think could never happen do happen. Everything can change in a moment, even on a random day in January. But then again, knowing Kobe, he would probably tell you there are no random days. Embrace every single day. All day, all in, all out. The Mamba mentality. I mean, it was so shocking then. And incredibly, I would even argue that it still hasn't fully sunk in a year later. So if you want to share your thoughts on that, as I mentioned, if you're in LA, check that. If you're from LA or if you spent any time in this town, you understand what I'm saying. If not, there's no way to explain it. 1-800-636-8686. At the top of hour number two, we're going to talk to the head football coach at Auburn, Brian Harsin. I also mentioned it's a very sad day in that we lost one of our own, a jungle icon, a member of the family. Trapper has passed on. And, man, Trapper went to battle with the devil, bravely fought the devil, cancer. And I will get into this next hour, but I do want to say right now that at the end of this hour, I don't ever remember the jungle without Trapper. Like when I think about the old school, old time OGs of the program, I think about the people who have called this show the longest. I don't ever remember doing this show and him not calling. That's how far back he goes. And I know a lot of you have been tweeting and sharing your thoughts, and we will definitely get into that next hour. On top of that, Davis Love III will be joining me in hour number three. And I'm still thinking about Kobe Bryant. Kobe came on in 2010 after the Lakers won a world championship. So much riding on it. So when you finally got to the finish line last night, were you feeling, how much of it was joy and how much of it was just relief? Like, the pressure's off. I got the win.
You know, it was both. But it was more joy, though. It was more joy. You know, this is a special group of guys. And I really enjoyed it because of that, because you know, it took a lot of intestinal, you know, inner fortitude for us to battle through this game, because you know, we were all tired, we were all drained, being down 13 to, you know, to a team that executes so well and you know, hardly ever makes mistakes. It was tough, but we just felt so much joy because we were able to look each other in the eye and to a man say, no, we're going to get this done. You know, it looks ugly right now, looks bleak right now, but we're going to get this done. And the joy comes from guys banding together and making it happen.
How long do you give yourself to unplug before you think about anything basketball or business related?
That's a great question. It's tough for me to think about anything but basketball. That's just the way I've been since I was like five. So it's going to be tough to do. But no, I'll take some time off physically and. You know, I got to look at my finger and, you know, see what the heck I'm going to do with this thing and kind of go from there.
In other words, you'll have breakfast and go get a lift in.
Pretty much.
Just so surreal, right? That was 2010, the day after the Lakers finished the Celtics in seven games and Kobe made it a point to come on the program, the day after. And just really surreal and chilling to hear his voice, and especially in that moment. Any credit card can offer cash back, but only Discover matches all the cash back you've earned at the end of your first year. It's like getting one of those birthday cards that's shaped like cash, so you already know there's cash inside before you even open it up. But in this case, it is stuffed with your first year cash back match, and you don't even have to send a thank you note. Cashback match only by Discover Card. Learn more at discover.com/match. Discover something brighter. Brian Harsin. Brian, great to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jim. Yeah, War Eagle, and excited to be here and looking forward to our start with our guys and with this staff as we move forward into 2021.
That sounds great. It's great to hear the War Eagle cry. It's great to have you back on the show, Brian. So you and I have spoken a number of times during your time at Boise State. I feel like I have a pretty good sense of what a good thing you had going with the Broncos. So what was it about this opportunity with Auburn that made you feel like you simply could not pass it up?
Yeah, well, you know my feeling about Boise State and the people there and Bronco Nation. But this was one of those opportunities. When I had a phone conversation with Alan Green, the athletic director, the vision for this program, the direction that they wanted to go, the people, and then obviously Auburn University and the opportunity to play in the SEC and the SEC West and a chance to play against the very best. And it really came down to the people and how my wife and I felt about bringing our family to Auburn, Alabama, and being a part of this program and the challenges that are ahead of us, but also the opportunities. And it was a good time for us. I felt good about the things that we had been a part of at Boise State and certainly looking forward to the challenges here at Auburn. And since I've been here, everything has been exactly what I expected. The people, the culture, the community, the players that we've got a chance to be around now, the staff that we're putting together. It's all been exactly what I hoped for, and just excited to be here. And this is a great place, and we're looking forward to the things that we can do here and what we're building.
There's an awful lot of good stuff in that response. He is the head football coach at Auburn, Brian Harsin. You mentioned the SEC West. I mean, it's one thing to join the SEC, but you're not just coaching in the SEC. You are coaching in the SEC West with Bama, with A&M, with Ole Miss. I mean, that's a meat grinder of teams and some of the best coaches in all college football. I think a lot of guys, Brian, might run from that sort of challenge. Why is that something you've decided to embrace and that you wanted to take on?
Well, it's all those teams and coaches you just mentioned. And I think as a competitor, this is the type of opportunity that you look for. And you want to compete against the best. You want to be a part of an opportunity to be the best yourself. And I think for the players here, the coaches that we've hired, that's been the mentality. If you're coming to Auburn, these are the things that we want to achieve. And you have that chance to do that in this league. And no doubt, the competition, the coaching, there's no shortage of greatness when it comes to the teams you're going to play, but that's exactly what you want to be a part of. I think as a competitor, that's what drives you, that's what motivates you, and that was part of the decision in coming to Auburn, was to be a part of that and have a chance and an opportunity to develop a program that can go compete with those teams and win those games and be a championship caliber program consistently.
We're talking to Brian Harsin. He is the head football coach at Auburn. You mentioned the guys that you've hired, the types of players you're looking to bring in. As an example, earlier this month, it was announced that former Vanderbilt head coach Derek Mason would join your staff as D coordinator. So how much does he bring to your staff, not just in terms of a defensive scheme, but his experience in that conference too?
Yeah, well, Coach Mason, one, great relationship with him that wasn't even really built through. It was through football, but wasn't about football. And when this opportunity came up, I watched him when he was at Stanford and we were at Boise State, watched him when he was at Vanderbilt as a head coach, got the chance to be around him on some vacation times and build a relationship with his wife and my wife. And so the connection was there, and I've always respected him as a coach, but he brings the experience of being in this league. He brings the defensive knowledge and understanding of what it is that we have to do to be successful. And then the connection piece as far as what we want to do with this team and the culture we want to build. I believe he and I are connected very well when it comes to the type of players and type of culture that we want to build here at Auburn. And since he's been here, it's been nothing but great days and a lot of great energy, very good vibe with the players around him, and then certainly just being able to have a head coach that's been a head coach before, and Mike Bobo, who's been a head coach before. There's some guys you can lean on and some decisions that need to be made as we've moved forward, and those guys have been in those situations. And so it's been a great resource for me as we put this staff together and start building towards the future of this program.
We're talking Auburn football. Brian Harsin, my guest. What about the players themselves? For instance, people who have played for you and been around your programs talk frequently about your ability to develop quarterbacks. Obviously, you play the position, but there are lots of guys who play it but can't teach it. How do you explain your ability to teach that and teach it well? And then what are the priorities you look for in a quarterback?
Well, one, you know, I think you look at the two quarterbacks that are going to play in the Super Bowl, and certainly one, Tom Brady, that absolutely is a difference maker in his belief ability to have guys believe in what he's capable of doing, and you see that with the Bucks, and then Patrick Mahomes, obviously very good, very talented, plays with great energy, and is prepared every single game. I think those are the key ingredients, right? You want to have good players, but in the development phase, it comes down to guys that want to develop and then being able to explain the position to them and coach them and do it consistently every single day. And it's more, you know, not just playing the game. It's more of a lifestyle, I believe, at that position. And the guys that really excel, they know what it takes. They do it consistently. They're extremely disciplined. They're tough players, and they're very focused on what it is they have to do each and every day to create that type of belief, to be that type of player, and to go out there and execute at the level that, you know, teams need from that position to be successful. So it's just a matter of really kind of putting that vision in their head of what it is that they're going to be capable of doing if they do these things, and then finding guys that want that and want to live that lifestyle and be a part of those things in your program.
I love that. I love the point that you just made, that it's more than just a job or an opportunity, but it's actually a lifestyle. I mean, is that one of the great separators? Is that the thing that separates the good from the great, or the great from the very best, that they live it, they approach it as a lifestyle as opposed to just a job or an opportunity?
I think so, Jim. I think it's more about the journey than it is the job. And there's just some people in life, and not just football, but you know when you meet them, all right? They're on a journey. They're always finding ways to improve. They're making people around them better because they just bring that that vibe every single day. And I think at the quarterback position, and really every position, if you're going to be great at something, it is the journey, and it is your self-determination. It is the things that you hold yourself accountable to each and every day. And we all know what it takes, but not everybody's willing to do it, and not everybody's willing to do it consistently. And when you look at a player like Tom Brady, and at his age, 40-plus years old, and still trying to master the position. And that's the beauty of it. It's still, he's played it so long, he's achieved so much, but you see when he plays, he's still trying to master something that at the end of the day is probably not something that anybody can master, but just he's striving for greatness. And to me, that is the lifestyle that you want to have from the people you surround yourself with every day.
Again, a great response. Brian Harsin, my guest. Before I let you go, you and I have talked cars in the past and drag racing. I understand your dad, Dale, he's got a 69 Mustang that ultimately is going to have 800 horsepower under the hood, a 6-speed transmission, and so much more. I mean, 800. Talk to me about that car. How special is that rig going to be when it's done?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's something that he and I, we purchased a couple of years back, and we've always talked about building the car. It's ridiculous the amount of horsepower it has to be on the street there, but if you're going to go big, all right, go big, and that's what we talked about. And to me, it's more about something that he and I have wanted to do together for a long time. I grew up drag racing. I grew up with him every weekend when we went out to the track, and that was something that I always appreciated and enjoyed. And so this was an opportunity for us to build something together because I have been away from drag racing for a few years. It's in my blood. I think about it every year. And, you know, I always appreciate my dad giving me an opportunity to see first class and to see how details matter. And so this was an idea that he had that I wanted to be a part of that he's really working on right now because I'm not there with him, that we will finish together. And, you know, a great relationship with him and something that symbolizes just how important he is to me and the things that he's allowed me to do growing up and his support for the things I've done.
That's the thing, the father-son relationship and that connection and that thing you share. Really quickly, am I reaching, Brian, or when you're building a car or you're drag racing or you're building something that goes that fast, that involves that kind of intricacy, is there any kind of connection between building that thing and the need to build it right and building a program the way you are right now and the need to build that thing right? Maybe it's not life and death, but the process itself, is it similar?
It is similar. I think, number one, just being first class in everything you do and making that a standard, how you treat people, how they feel when they're around you, and the way you do things, that's really your own personal excellence. And then the details, when you're talking about a race car and you're talking about putting yourself behind 2,000 horsepower and taking it down the track, every detail matters. Every bolt on that engine matters. And I think in a program, it's no different. Everything you do, being on time, doing the work necessary, coaches, players, understanding the details of things that you want to accomplish, I think it's all the same. And like I said earlier, I think it goes back to that journey that you're on. Is that what you're about? Are these the things that are important to you? And if they are, you're emphasizing it every day, and you're going to make sure that the people that are a part of what it is you're doing understand that this is the standard and how we do things. And so I don't see it any differently. I learned that a long time ago, and I learned it on the track and from my dad, and I don't see that any different as we put this program at Auburn together and try to build this team and this staff the right way, and that'll be through the details that I've learned a long time ago.
Clearly, the standard is the standard, and this is the next stop in a journey. Brian Harsin is the head football coach at Auburn. Brian, I appreciate you very much, and this is an interview that I would definitely listen to again myself. Thanks so much for doing that, Brian. I know we'll do it again soon.
All right, Jim. Appreciate you. War Eagle.
See, one of the most unique aspects of this show is the prominence of the caller. I don't take a lot of calls. I never have. But that doesn't mean that the callers aren't extremely important on this program. The prominence of the caller. Ever since day one, some 3 decades ago, I always put an extremely high standard on what I would expect from the listeners if they were to pick up the phone and make a phone call. Remember, there is a difference between the listener and the caller. Very few people actually call the program. There are a lot of people listening that would never, ever pick up the phone. How many of you listening right now have never once called me or the show? How many of you listening right now have never even thought to call the show? But if you're going to call the show, you're impacting the bottom line and the product, so there is a standard. The standard is the standard. Now, the standard usually produces the best and funniest callers you will ever hear on the AM dial, or the absolute worst. I've always said this, right? Give me an A or give me an F. And that's always been 100% by design. Because either you are one of the select few who can meet that standard, who can meet that bar and legitimately elevate the program, legitimately make the show better, or you're on the other side. And then you fall spectacularly and hilariously short, which also in a way makes the show better. So this produces memorable phone calls. This produces memorable callers. And the memorable callers become characters on the program. And characters on this show can start to feel like friends. And friends can even start to feel like family. And speaking of family, it's long been said that the jungle is one big dysfunctional family. We might not always agree with one another. We may not always like one another, but we can all gather around the same table every single day for hours at a time. And for the most part, we're happy that everybody else is here. How many radio programs can say that? How many radio programs have dozens and dozens of callers who are known on a first name basis by a listening audience that they'd never once even met? A lot of you listening right now can trace your time with this show back to when I first started in the 90s, and you're still here with me, even today. And then there are names like Kerwin, Terrence, Doc Mike. They mean something to you because you heard them back then and you still remember them now. Those guys are show legends, even if they don't come around anymore. They always will be. But then you have some that started back then and never really left and always came around and were always present. And maybe one man stands above the rest as the most well-known caller to ever pick up a phone and dial into this program. Because if I had to single one person out, and it's hard to do, but if I had to single one person out, it might be this person because he did it early and he did it often and nobody ever did it like him. And of course, I'm speaking of Trapper and Dana Point. Instead of telling you when he started calling my program, I would put it another way. I don't ever remember the jungle without him. I don't ever remember doing this show and him not calling. I mean, how's that for gravity? I don't remember Trapper ever not being a part of the program. Certainly there were times in the midst of his battle that he wouldn't call for a while, but he never ever really left. He was always here. And he is the very definition of a jungle OG. This was a guy who was in the inaugural Smack-Off in 1996 and also the 2020 Smack-Off. You want to talk about longevity. You want to talk about relevance. But it does go beyond that with Trapper. We're talking about an unmistakable voice, an authentic delivery, and takes that consistently split the jungle right down the middle, right in half. I mean, has there ever been a caller more polarizing than Trapper? Half the audience loved him. Half the audience hated me for taking that phone call. But everybody across the board would hang on every word because either it was gospel to you or something to shred to pieces as soon as you hung up. Trapper, a made man in the jungle, known for dropping Bruce Springsteen lines at the end of every call. Trapper, a voice that you can hear in your head without hearing it first on the radio. Trapper, a fiercely loyal clone. Fiercely loyal all the way to the very end. And then yesterday, sadly, many of you started to tweet that he had passed. And then we received a call confirming it. And if you've been listening to this show for the past half decade or so, then you know that he had been dancing with the devil that is cancer. And let the record reflect, he gave the devil hell. There are a lot of things that I'll never forget about Trapper. But the fact that he continued to call this show and participate during his chemo and his radiation therapy and treatments will be at the very top of the list. And even though Trapper, like every single one of us, had made mistakes, he served as a massive inspiration to a lot of people as he took the fight right to the most wretched of illnesses and he brought us along for the ride. Stories would get back to me through the phones and email and social media. The Trapper would connect with other clones fighting cancer and support them along the way, which speaks to who he was and the reach of the show and the sense of jungle community and what that jungle community meant to him personally. So my thoughts and my condolences are with his family, with his loved ones. I'm very sorry for your loss. Truly sorry. I also want to say the Trapper will go down as one of, if not the most iconic callers in show history. Like, his loyalty to the show, to me personally, over the decades, is not going to be forgotten. And his memory will certainly live on through the hundreds of phone calls that he made to the jungle. He's a brother. He's a made man. We all love him. He is Trapper in Dana Point. Great to have you on, brother. How you doing, Trapper?
Somewhere back in the 20th century, I think you designated me the social conscience of the jungle. And once again, it was a very rough year for anyone with a conscience here in the land of the free. If there's a guy who walks his talk when it comes to the topic of evil, Donnie, and has a seat on the bench in hell in the next life, it's Donald Rumsfeld. You want to talk about real hoes? You talk about Rupert and Fox boning out a dirty 30 pieces to Pimp Orenthal.
You don't kick another man's dog, you sure don't discipline his kids, and you sure don't pour him out another man's wife.
David, I sent enough people to Pelican Bay, Susanville, Chowchilla, San Quentin. A few more, enough to know the score.
Simon, you're the smart mouth bitch who plays straight man to a drooling Laker girl. Jimmy here in Seville, Spain on July 28th for Bruce and East Street. I got that next round of Heineken's. And yeah, the sun also rises.
My cousin, he got vaporized at the Pentagon. But I got a soccer take. God, forgive me. What's the next left turn circuit?
Only 6 shopping days left to Christmas. Obviously, a Republican Christmas.
Yeah, bitch. I mean, what are you, the Grinch, the Scrooge, or just another whiny freaking Democrat Trapper?
Running for district attorney in Del Norte County.
We were certified with a 196-vote win.
All you clones out there that have to go to the commie card and believing rhyming Trapper with Crapper makes you the next Walt Whitman.
Crapper!
Open up the sewer lines and we're going to hear the infamous no from some manure pile called the clones.
We hunt where and when we want while the rest of you jackals yip and yowl from a safe distance and then sniff our scat after we leave.
You puerile pubescent patronizing punks as the game of the legs to run, much less outlast me.
But never more so, Jimmy, than the days following 9/11 when you in the jungle, you stayed on the air, you gutted it out, and you gave a lot of us a shot of humanity and decency that brought some of us back from the edge.
You all out there and you, Jim, are one of the main reasons I'm going to beat this son of a bitch.
I'm Trapper. I'm a made man, and you're not. Here's your 30 pieces of silver.
Bring it on, bitches.
As always, tramps like us, babe. I'm out.
Tramps like us. Man, my man love Bruce. Tramps like us, 30 pieces of silver. You're Trapper. They're not. A made man through and through. Trapper and Dana Point. Again, an inspiration for his marathon fight against cancer. A true jungle OG. Rest in peace, brother. And I appreciate you and what you have meant to this show. And to the jungle. And to me personally. If you would like to share your thoughts, please do so. 1-800-636-8686. I'll take telephone calls and I will certainly read your emails. And if you want to get through on social media, if you want to tweet your thoughts, go ahead and do that too. You know, I've done this a long time. And those callers, like Trapper, I just think about Trapper. Trapper would hit the road on the world tour back in the day when I did those appearances. And inevitably, no matter where I went, no matter where we went, no matter where we took the show, he was there. He was there, and he was a part of that jungle brotherhood. I'll never forget 1996 when we did the famous Sports Illustrated shoot. Trapper had somehow worked his way into our building. You know, he was an OG. He was jungle inside, and he had a lot of grit, a lot of heart, and a lot of hustle. Found his way inside, and I don't remember thinking it was an issue at all. Like, it was just Trapper. But not only did Trapper come inside, Trapper was not going to come inside without bearing gifts. Trapper made this enormous pot of chili for the crew, for the XR4TI. And the only thing more amazing, this was back when I worked for another company and we were on Ventura Boulevard in the 818. And it was a big, big building, and it had this long, sprawling hallway. And I don't know why this happened, but he made the chili, and the chili was good, really good chili. And we had it, and for some reason, he left the chili. It wasn't like he was going to take it home. Hey, you fellas have it. It's for you. For some reason, we didn't clean the pot and then send it back to him. And we didn't finish the chili. For some reason, somebody thought that it would be a good idea to leave the chili out exposed on a shelf. And we left it there. And then it became a thing. Like, I wonder before somebody, or how long before somebody picks that thing up. And nobody did, because it was a really busy workplace. And for whatever reason, me and the crew at the time thought that was funny. And it just stayed there, and it stayed there, and it stayed there. It stayed there for a day, and then 2 days, and then to the weekend. And the thinking was, the cleaning crew is going to pick this thing up. There's no way the chili jumps the weekend, but it did. I'm not kidding you. This giant pot of chili was there like a month. Who knows what kind of science experiment we were running at that point. But when I think of Trapper, I think of a million different things. Let's go to Huntington Beach. Silk goes way, way, way back with Trapper. Good morning, bro.
What's up, bro? It's been a tough month, man. I just want to thank everyone who reached out last night. You know, the clones really rally. Even got a reach out from Rome Show guest, clone himself, SoCal legend, Chris Geeter McGee. What up to Geets? When I met Trapper, I was in my early 20s, and I never met anyone like him. He was larger than life, prominent defense attorney in OC. I mean, the guy was in the newspaper, on TV. The way he partied and stuff, I mean, it just blew me away. I'd never seen anything like it. He just, he lived this wild, wild life down there in South County. And, you know, the way I remember him most, though, is from the tour stops. And for those of us who've listened to the show as long as we have and called the show, you know, we've seen your transition from, you know, 690 and then to your syndication. And I always noticed that, so from the tour stops to Charlie Brown's and the National, then when you started doing the nationwide tour stops, we could all tell that you were kind of moving up and getting yourself an organization and taking things in a more professional way. But of course, we all kind of stayed the same. And just our interactions with you, we could see how stoked you were when you showed up in another state. And then sometimes we were even on the plane with you, but you know, you would see us there. And it was this kind of mixture of stoke that we were there and pumping you up and you were seeing familiar faces, but also like, oh no, these guys are the same crazy guys from 97 and it's now like 04. How are we going to handle this? And you were always cool with us and stuff, but you know, Trapper was one of those guys on the tour stops, man, the Tampa infamous tour stop. I mean, he would get up to stuff and you could barely contain him. You could, you know, he just did whatever he wanted, the three-piece suits, the dark glasses. So I'll just always have happy memories of Trapper and how he lived on the edge. But, you know, the guy went from defense attorney to prosecutor, and they really should make a movie out of his life, bruh. That's it for me. Tramps like us, bruh. Later, bruh.
Appreciate that, so thanks so much. Let's go to Oregon. Lorna in Oregon. Hi, Lorna. How are you?
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I'm Lorna. I'm Trapper's sister.
Lorna. Hi, I'm so sorry. Lorna, I'm so sorry for your loss.
Sorry, I just wanted to tell you that Saturday, I was sitting with him, and he was trying to tell me words to call into your show, which I have never done, and just to say some things in case he didn't make it. And I think what he really wanted to let you know is you were family. You were truly his family. Even his haters were his family. And I think what kept him going for the past 6 years was he lived to call into the show and state his views on whatever. And, you know, Trapper, lived a life of unimaginable adventures. And he possessed the heart of a lion, the talent of a master author. He had no quit in him. He was a man of honor, humor, the heart of a lion, brilliant, talented, and kind. And all the while having found the lowest times in his life and being able to get back up and survive them again. And yes, he bit off more than he can chew many times, but he ate it up, spit it out, faced it all, and he stood tall. And Trapper always did it his way. He was a Jersey boy at heart. He had a life that he lived at full tilt. And his memories and affection left behind will never be diminished. And, you know, it was his choices, but he always did it his way. And he had such passion and compassion and heart for everybody. And he just so wanted to thank you for letting him be a part of the Jim Rome Show and part of your life, because you were a huge, huge factor in his life. Again, kept him going for probably the past 6 years when he was given 6 months to a year to live, and he lived just shy of 6 years. And, you know, during chemo, during radiation therapy, it didn't matter. He was always writing down what he wanted to say on the show, or having me write it down, and he will truly be missed. He died at home. He died. I was by his side. His dog was under his arm, and he died a very peaceful death. And the way I know him, I mean, he's a political junkie. He's a Jim Rome junkie. He's a family junkie, and he's in rock and roll heaven, probably holding court and starting some kind of sports show up there. So thank you to you, Jim, and all of your production people for all the years that I truly believe in my heart you gave to him, because that was the driving force that kept him going.
It's really hard, Lorna. In all my years of doing this, I'm not sure that I've ever had a phone call quite like that. I am really sorry for your loss. I think that was an amazing phone call, Lorna. That was really courageous and really strong and really beautifully said.
Good night,